Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, and welcome to Vulgar History, a feminist women's history comedy podcast. My name is Anne Foster, and this is season 4. And it's been a minute, but here we are, all together again to talk about some scandalicious women from history. And so I just wanted to just bring up one thing, because I got a comment. I don't get many comments. You're all very keep your thoughts to yourselves, and I respect that. But I did get one anonymous comment from someone who said that I talk too quickly. And to that person, I would just like to share that, you know, in most podcast apps, there's a way where you can slow down how someone is talking. So that's a great option for you. And otherwise, if you think I talk too quickly, then don't listen to my podcast, because this is how my voice works. So welcome. Welcome, everybody. I like to have a theme per season, and this season's theme is women trapped in towers and the assholes who put them there. That's how I'm going to say it. Women trapped in towers and the assholes who put them there. So by towers, I'm talking about prisons, jails. We've talked in other episodes about how oldie time rich women didn't go into like prison so much as it was just like being an unwelcome house guest for like 32 years or whatever. Mary Queen of Scots, my queen. So we're going, as per usual, in one of these seasons, we're going to go kind of chronological, which I find helpful to me just to try and keep track of who is who, especially because there's a lot of people this season named Edward. And so this way we can be like, oh, remember the guy from 2 episodes ago? His grandson, you know, so we can just like see everything all in order. And let's just get into it. Today we are talking about Margaret of Anjou. My sources are Wikipedia, which I just need to say is where I start with everything, because that's where I'm just like, what's the birth date? What's the death date? What are the like subject headings? Like, is there a Wikipedia? Like, which is not to say if someone doesn't have a Wikipedia page, I'm not going to research them. But it's just like, if they do, I'm just like, oh, thank God. Because that points you towards other sources. You can get sort of a broad picture of them. I know some people, do they still, would hate on Wikipedia? Because it's like, anyone can write anything. Like, don't use it for your like class projects or whatever. But anyway, I'm not ashamed to say I use Wikipedia. And I also give them a monthly donation because they're very helpful. They could use a lot more women being written about in Wikipedia, and that's an issue for another day. So I also looked at an article from History Extra, and if you don't know, BBC History Extra is a magazine, and it's also a podcast, and they get great historians to write about. Like, the articles that I often read in their magazine are concise, and is often sort of from someone who wrote a book about this, but this is them kind of giving the major points of it. So this is an article by, does it not say who it's by? I want to give somebody a shout out. Sarah Gristwood. Yeah. So she's the author of the book Blood Sisters, The Women Behind the War of the Roses. And this article is called The Power Behind the Throne, Women in the Wars of the Roses. And I also used her book. So there's a podcast called In Our Time, History. And they did an episode about Margaret of Anjou. I also looked at an essay from RebeccaStarBrown.com. She's another historian whose stuff is very readable, fun to read. There's a book called The Shadow King by Lauren Johnson, which is great. It's about Henry the Sixth, who is the husband of Margaret of Anjou, and actually is an interview with her that I heard that made me interested in reading more about Margaret of Anjou. And then also the book She Wolves by Sarah Castor. So Margaret of Anjou was born on March 23rd, 1430. Now, I need to let you know that this episode, there's a lot of French names, people names, place names. There's going to be at least one other episode like that this season, and I uncontrollably like to say those with a French accent. So again, if that bothers you, then there are other podcasts for you to listen to, but that's going to happen here, and we just all need to be okay with that. Margaret was born on March 23rd, 1430 at Pont-à-Mousson in Lorraine. So this is before France was one place. It was like all these little kingdoms that we now consider France that are basically kind of where France is now, but they're all their own little things. So Lorraine was one of these places. It was, in fact, a fief of the Holy Roman Empire east of France, ruled by a cadet branch of French kings, the House of Valois-Anjou. And she's Margaret of Anjou, remember? Margaret was the second daughter of Good King René, which is a name, I haven't done tons of French history reading, but René is a name that feels not like someone who would live in 1430. So that makes me like him even better. Here's my cat making an appearance for season, first appearance this season. So her father was called René, aka Good King René. Literally, he was called that. Who was the Duke of Anjou and King of Naples, Sicily, and Jerusalem. And if you're like, wait, that's a weird assortment of things to be king of? Like, Naples, Sicily, and Jerusalem are not necessarily super close to each other. And also, if you're like, that's a familiar congregation of places, it is, because guess what? Good King René is a great-grandson of Joanna of Naples from season whatever. I did that before. And her mother was Isabella, the Duchess of Lorraine. And through them, Margaret of Anjou could trace her lineage back to powerful women like Empress Matilda, who we talked about on the podcast before, and Eleanor of Aquitaine, a woman who I will talk about on the podcast, I'm sure, but honestly, her story is very confusing to me, and I need a lot of time to figure it out. So, her mother, Isabella of Lorraine, fought wars on behalf of her husband, Good King René. So, Good King René was imprisoned. And while he was imprisoned, Isabella ruled the Duchy of Lorraine by her own right. And then also, Margaret of Anjou's grandmother, Good King René's mom, was Yolanda of Aragon, who ruled the Duchy of Anjou as regent for her son while Margaret was a child, repelling English military presence and supported the disinherited Dauphin. Again, I don't know a lot about French history, and we're really talking about Margaret, who becomes a person in, spoiler, English history. But basically what we're looking at here is her mother and her grandmother both ruled Lorraine and or Anjou on their own right, so she would have seen them growing up, role models for her. As we will see, she did not hesitate to take power when she saw that was an option. Margaret of Anjou had five brothers and four sisters, as well as three half-siblings from Good King René's relationships with mistresses. This is just going back over that. So when Good King René was taken captive by enemies, Isabella fought for his return while she was ruling. And at that point, Margaret was raised by her grandmother, Yolanda, who had previously ruled as well. So she like was direct contact with these cool women. When Margaret was 12, Good King René was returned. And so she would have seen in this like early childhood era, both how decisive and powerful women can be in positions of power, but also how precarious that power can be for men like her father, who was, quote, title rich, but power poor. So Good King René was the king of these places and also the Duke of Anjou, but he didn't have a lot of political power. He just kind of had titles. So her mother, Isabella, took care of Margaret's education and may have arranged for her to have lessons with the scholar Antoine de La Salle, who taught her brothers. So Margaret was getting like a good education for a girl. I'm going to guess not every girl was getting education to this level, but Isabella was into that. In childhood, Margaret was known as La Petite Creature, the little creature, which I guess is like a positive thing to say in French. As a child, she was interested in hunting as well. Margaret was described as beautiful and furthermore, quote, already a woman, passionate and proud and strong-willed. So like quite a force of personality as a young person. So when she was 14 in 1444, she was betrothed to Henry VI of England, who was at that time 21. And I think as we've seen in numerous episodes of this podcast, that's one of the better age gaps you're going to find. The whole marriage was part of a broader attempt at peace between England and France. So Henry VI, if you've watched, which I've talked about on the podcast before, I'm just remembering, there is a multi-part British miniseries called The Hollow Crown that is all of the Shakespeare plays with kings in the titles. One of those plays is Henry VI, and he is played by Tom Sturridge. And it really made me feel for Henry VI and get what he's all about. I think I'm going to explain what Henry was like. But basically, his grandfather was Henry IV, who was like a great king. And his father was Henry V, who was like the great king or whatever. And he became king as a baby and was not, he was a pacifist and not super decisive as a person. So this marriage was part of a broader attempt at peace between England and France, two countries at war so often. So Henry himself couldn't be married to one of the French princesses because technically he considered himself the king of France. And that would be awkward because if he married a princess, that would be like him saying that there is a French king who is not me. So he, anyway, it just got awkward, so he couldn't do that. So his team was trying to find a young woman who wasn't a princess, but who was French and also was royal and around the right age to start having children, which meant Margaret of Anjou. So some of her other family relationships, she was like very, it's that complex family tree of like everyone's related to everyone. Some of her other family relationships included her aunt Marie was the wife of the French king, is how I wrote that. But I guess not the queen, because technically Henry was the... Anyway, her aunt was married to the French king. Her cool grandmother, Yolanda, had supported the French king during some of these like dark times of war with England. And although Good King René wasn't wealthy or powerful, he was well-liked. So for all these reasons, she, age 14, was officially married to Henry by proxy. So the sort of marriage where like a woman would have, or probably a man, in England like stood in for her there and they had a ceremony, and then she would have married a man standing for Henry in France and they like hadn't met each other. So they were married by proxy, and then she stayed home with her mother, Isabella. So she's technically queen of England / France, but was just living with her mom for several more months while more paperwork was settled for her to actually move over. She was finally sent over to England, but was too seasick to take part in the celebrations for her arrival. Seasick, and I put in brackets, or whatever sick. Like, she just was not doing well. Understandable. The predicted turnout for her arrival in procession was so large that an inspection of roofs and balconies was ordered due to the expectation that spectators would climb onto the roofs and balconies to try and watch her progress, but she was sick, so there wasn't anything to see. So their in-person marriage was held April 23rd, 1445, and at which point she was crowned Queen of England. Oh, sorry. They were married on April 23rd, and then she was crowned Queen of England on May 30th by the Archbishop of Canterbury, literally a teen queen. So, note. Henry, who was more interested in religion and learning than in military matters, was not a successful king. I do not mean to say he's not a successful person or human being, but like to be king of England in 1445, this was not the disposition, personality, or interests that would have been most successful. He had reigned since he was only a few months old, like his father died very young, when he was very young, and his actions his whole life have been controlled by protectors, men who were effectively his regent, even though he was now an adult. He was a pacifist, leading a country during a precarious wartime period, micromanaged by ambitious men who didn't want him to have any more power, and it was just not a good scene for him or for Margaret to enter into. So shortly after the coronation, her dad, good King Rene, entered negotiations with, I guess, the protectors, attempting to barter a lifetime's alliance and a 20-year truce between England and France in exchange. Oh my god, this is complicated. What he wanted was for Henry to abandon his claim to Anjou. That didn't happen. And actually, there was the loss of Maine, which is a place in France. Basically, just some paperwork stuff happened. Margaret, at this point, she corresponded with the French king regarding the agreement, attempting to act as a mediator, which was not successful, but she was 14 years old and there was a lot of people doing a lot of stuff. She probably didn't have that much sway. So because of this whole thing, the loss of Maine. Okay, so Maine had been controlled by the English, but then it went back to the French? Anyway, the loss of Maine was regarded by the English public as a betrayal, and it was very unpopular, and they were, which made them even more likely to mistrust Margaret due to her French origins. Because if you've been at war and then like someone comes from the other country to be like, I'm 14 and I'm the queen, like, I don't know. That's why they were suspicious. The reputation of Margaret's marriage suffered as a result, although she herself was not openly blamed for the loss of Maine, which again was a place in France. Did you know that? I did not. But as long as she did her job and birthed an heir soon, it would be cool and probably people would get over it. But guess what? That did not happen. In the early years of their marriage, Margaret and Henry spent significant proportions of their time together by choice. What? They enjoyed each other's company? How unusual. They shared an interest in education and culture. And in 1448, so age 18, she was granted license to found Queen's College in Cambridge. There's little evidence in those early years that she was doing any public political efforts other than that, initially trying to be the mediator for that thing. Let's see. So most of her surviving letters from this early-ish period, they pertain to stuff that would have been expected for a queen to do. Mediation, intervention in matters in which she had been asked to act, such as the arranging of marriages. These were expected and important parts of the role of a noblewoman or queen. So of these things she did that was apparently cool for her to do, some of them were successful, others were regarded as bad ideas. For instance, in one occasion, she recommended a man named Alexander Manning to the role of jailer at Newgate. So she like gave him a reference. Shortly after he got the job of jailer, he turned the prisoners loose in an act of protest at his rumored dismissal for negligence, and then he was jailed himself. Wait, so she recommended him for the job. He was not good at it. He heard that maybe he's going to be fired, so then he just like let the prisoners out. So, oops. But the thing is, years were passing and rumors swirled about why these two young people were not having babies yet. Like, the whole point of her being there was to have heirs to, that was the point. So here's the thing. Henry was known to be extremely pious, like to the point even after marriage he potentially didn't want to have sex because that is how pious he was. He's kind of a monk type person. Or potentially, like in Bridgerton, maybe they didn't know how sex works and how to conceive a child. And if neither of them knew, then like, what are you going to do? There were also rumors that Henry's evil advisors were always around, ensuring the pair didn't have a baby because they didn't want there to be an heir for some reason. So they were not having children. This became increasingly problematic as the years went by. It was potentially because Henry did not want to have sex with her, and it was potentially because they did not know how to have sex. But also, the main advisor getting in Margaret's way was Richard, the Duke of York. So these two did not get along. Margaret persuaded Henry to recall Richard, like to remove him from his post as governor in France and banish him to Ireland. Apparently, and this is where I'm just like, I like you, Margaret. Apparently, she repeatedly attempted to have him assassinated during his travels to and from Ireland, once in 1449 and again in 1450. Good for her, because if she didn't like him, I bet he sucked. So, but then in 1450, Richard, the Duke of York, returned from Ireland and was readmitted as a trusted advisor. I'm not sure why, but just because everyone's allegiances were just coming and going and changing, and someone liked him, and so they let him do that. So we're now into Margaret versus Richard, round, I guess, three at this point. Like, she tried to assassinate him twice, which makes me feel like maybe he tried to assassinate her first. Drama. But this time Richard came out on top because for some reason, well, I mean, he came out on top of this battle because, and we know this because Henry suggested Richard should be named his heir, which is wild because Richard was older than him. Margaret was like, what are you doing? And within a few months, then she gained control over him. So he was just this person who was just kind of passive and people just, but he was the king, so you had to convince him to side with you. And then I think Richard went back to Ireland again. There's just a lot of coming and going. For like 2 years after that, there were a bunch of military failures that resulted in England losing most of its French lands. And some loyalists to Richard were like, hey, Richard, want to come back and take over? We kind of need you to lead the armed forces. And Richard was like, I got you. So he was very popular with like the common folk. So he raised an army at Shrewsbury while Henry and Margaret assembled forces in London. And these were forces, to be clear, against each other. Like, Richard was trying to take over being king. There was a standoff south of London. Richard presented a list of grievances and demands that included the arrest of a person named Edmund Beaufort, the Duke of Somerset. We're just going to call him Somerset because there's going to be other Edmunds, I think. So who was this person? Edmund Beaufort, Duke of Somerset. So he had, when Richard was away, Somerset had kind of slipped into that power void and had been Henry's main advisor in tandem with Margaret. There were rumors that they had an affair. Shakespeare certainly thought so. Not that he was born for another 200 years. Did they have an affair? Who cares? But Richard said they did. And people were like really not liking Margaret. And they were ready to think she was like this sexy French woman having affairs. So then the king agreed to arrest Somerset. But Margaret was like, please don't do that. And like, it's just back and forth. Like, Henry's just like so easily, his loyalty just keeps changing who he's loyal to. So 1453, Margaret, age 23. Somerset's influence had been restored. Richard was again on the outs. And plus, finally, Margaret was pregnant. Finally. So either someone had taught them how to have, well, this is part of the thing where people are like, ooh, maybe she had an affair. Like, if they were married for almost 10 years and had no children, and then suddenly she did, people are like, oh, maybe she must have had sex with someone else. And maybe she did. Or maybe just finally someone explained to them how babies are made. Or maybe, if you know the story of Catherine de' Medici, there was a thing where she didn't have children for a long time, but it turned out that was because her husband's penis was weirdly shaped. And so you had to, like, have sex with him in this, like, unconventional, unusual position, which the king's mistress taught her how to do. And that's a story for another day. But anyway, this is, I'm sure, great relief to lots of people. Margaret was finally pregnant. But unfortunately, due to a combination of continued military losses, which is what happens when your king is a pacifist during war, her husband, well, and just other emotional situations, Henry went into a deep depressive state before the baby was born. So what was his deal? I mean, we don't know. Some people have suggested schizophrenia or other mental issues, but it sounds to me just like really severe depression of someone who had this kind of shitty life where people are always telling him what to do. He had to be a war king when he wanted to just be like a little monk guy. He was described as having no energy, and he existed in effectively like a catatonic stupor, like sort of a waking coma, not reacting to anyone. So he was like that when his heir, Margaret's son, Edward, was born in 1453. And then there was a whole thing about a king needs to be like, this is my son, hi, this is my son, like publicly, but like he couldn't do that. So then there's a whole thing about like, is it his son? And also when the king is in basically a catatonic stupor, there was a big thing about like, well, who's going to be in charge of literally the country? Because we're still at war. Margaret argued that she should take over the way her mother and grandmother had when the king had been indisposed. But of course, Richard was still there. And he'd been sort of one of the managers when Henry was a baby king. So he was like, I know this job, like, just let me do it. And simultaneously, while Henry was still in his depressive coma-like state, Richard, Duke of York, gained a very important ally, also named Richard, which was Richard Neville, the Earl of Warwick, who we're going to just call Warwick. Or is it Warwick? Anyway, we're going to call him Warwick now because there's a multitude of Richards. Warwick was super influential, very powerful, and also very rich. With Warwick's help, Richard was named regent as protector of the realm in 1454. Margaret was excluded completely from having any power at all, and Edmund Beaufort Somerset was detained in the Tower of London. While many of Richard's supporters spread rumors that Edward was not really the king's son, but the son of Somerset. After a year, Henry emerged from his depressive state. He publicly acknowledged Edward as his son, which was important. And he removed Richard as being in charge because, like, he's the king and he's back. And he tried to undo everything Richard had done to make it like there was never a lost year at all. But lots had changed during the time he was unavailable and he wasn't able to just take everything back to how it was before. He was also mad when he heard that Margaret wanted to take over and Richard wouldn't let her because he liked his wife, Margaret. Now, because of their very convoluted family tree, like, there were Wars of the Roses, aka the Cousins Wars, just like when I was watching The Hollow Crown, the British series about it, I made myself a murder board. Like, I bought a bulletin board thing, little cards, and I made cards and I attached them to the string to just be like, who's the father of who was killed by who? Like, I can't keep track of this whole story. But basically the family tree is everyone is really closely related to everyone. So Richard, Duke of York, was, you know how he tried to take over being king? He kind of had a reason to think that. He was a credible claimant to the English throne because of who his ancestors were, which were the same ancestors as Henry. And by the end of his kind of one-year period as fake king, there were many powerful nobles and relatives prepared to back him as king because he'd been basically not so secretly planning to take over as king ever since his days as baby Henry's regent. Henry was a gentle person, but had also been groomed by Richard and others to be very trusting and pliable and not to stand up for himself. But Margaret had not been raised like that. She saw what was going on and she was like, hell no. But from now on, Henry was more like post-coma. Henry was more fragile and prone to mental health-based crises, which meant just this power vacuum that Richard and Margaret were eternally trying to fill. So May 1455, just over 5 months after Henry VI recovered from another bout of mental illness, like aka depressive fugue state, Margaret called for a great council of all the kind of like advisors, and she specifically did not invite Richard or Team York. Richard was very mad about that, and soon Soon he and his troops were marching to face off against Margaret's troops, or slash Henry's troops, aka the Lancastrian troops. This was the Battle of Northampton in 1460, at which point Henry was taken prisoner by Richard, just like it happened to good King Rene. So now Margaret's just like her mom, king slash husband in jail, and she needs to take over. And then, as my notes say, battles, with Margaret stepping in as the leader of Team Lancastrians. As a woman, though, she was thought to only be able to act through deputies. Although, fun fact, 30 years earlier, her grandmother Yolanda, a powerful protector to Joan of Arc, they had been friends, had worn silver armor and led her own troops against the English. So again, Margaret has, like, role models to look up to in this situation. So this is kind of like unknown because of how long ago it happened and who is writing the records. But did she actually lead troops, or did she just tell people to go be troops? Because time and again, reports would speak of Margaret's Lancastrian forces rather than of Henry's. At the Second Battle of St. Albans, one reporter seems to suggest that she was actually literally there fighting. Maybe she was, maybe she wasn't. But she was certainly in charge. An anecdotal report of his speech, once credited to Margaret, is as heroic as the one that Elizabeth I did, where she was like, I'm a might have a body of a weak woman, but I'm like strong like a man, or whatever she said. So Margaret apparently said, I've often broken the English battle line. I've mowed down ranks far more stubborn than theirs are now. You who once followed a peasant girl, Joan of Arc, now follow a queen. I will either conquer or be conquered with you. She might have said that in French. I don't know. So, but as, you know, a strong, independent woman, and also a French woman in the middle of a French-English war, she became a scapegoat for many things. For instance, Richard's, like, he'd been spreading the rumors that Edward was illegitimate, that Henry wasn't the father, that she was basically, like, a whore, etc. There were rumors, you know, people wrote vulgar ballads about her, and her power waned because of sexism. Anyway, so at the Second Battle of St. Albans, which I think I just mentioned, so she defeated the York forces, led by Warwick, and she recaptured Henry, her husband, who had been imprisoned at this point for literally a year. Being imprisoned, guess what, triggered another bout of mental health issues for this fragile man. He was allegedly laughing and singing as the battle raged around him. The king had promised, so there's two York guards who had been guarding him, and he promised them immunity because I guess they became friends. But Margaret was like, no. And she had them both executed. It is alleged that she put these two men on trial with her 8-year-old son, Prince Edward, in charge of the trial, and a real sort of like Cersei Joffrey vibes moment. And she allegedly asked, fair son, what death shall these knights die? Prince Edward apparently replied their heads should be cut off, despite the king's pleas for mercy, because Henry had zero power except for being king. At around this time, Richard died in battle? Presumably, or of whatever, dysentery. And the new head of Team York was his son, Edward, who was young and also hot. So at the Battle of Towton, hot Edward defeated the Lancastrian forces, deposed Henry, and named himself King Edward the Fourth. So, I mean, it's quite a change. But he failed to capture Henry and Margaret, and so they fled to Scotland. During the first part of the reign of hot Edward, Lancastrian resistors, so like supporters of Henry and Margaret, continued, mainly under Margaret's leadership, because Henry was just like not equipped for that. So there's some nobles still loyal to them in the northern parts of England and Wales, even though Hot Edward was now the king. Just for the record, Hot Edward is the one who married Elizabeth Woodville, and in The White Queen, he is really hot, and in The Hollow Crown, he's really hot. So then what happened? So during this time of resistance, Margaret teamed up with the Scottish. Okay, so the Scottish king was a baby. A lot of baby kings, called James, because Scottish kings are always called James. So there was baby King James of Scotland's mother was called Mary of Guelders, and she became friends with Margaret. So Mary was still mourning her recently dead husband and was the regent for King Baby James, because Scottish kings always named James. So Mary offered refuge for Margaret and was very helpful to her in this time. You know, women helping women. Mary gave a number of Scottish troops to help Margaret / Lancastrians. Mary and Margaret also organized a betrothal between Margaret's son, Prince Edward, and Mary's daughter, Margaret. The names in this are just like an unending cycle of the same names. In return for her support, Mary asked for the town of Berwick on the Anglo-Scottish border, which is like, I'll help you, but can I like literally have a town? Margaret was like, no, that's not something I'm willing to give you. And so relations between the two gal pals deteriorated, exacerbated by the increasingly friendly alliance between Hot King Edward and Duke Philip of Burgundy. I'm not sure what he's up to, but it all has to do with alliance things. So Edward, Hot Edward, tried to put a stop to Mary's support of Margaret by proposing marriage to the widowed queen, Hot Edward. This is pre-Elizabeth Woodville era. So Hot Edward proposed marriage to Mary in Scotland. Mary was like, no. Oh, here we go. Mary's uncle, Duke Philip of Burgundy, was her uncle. Pressure her to call off the engagement. Anyway, in 1462, Mary paid the Lancastrian royals to leave Scotland and made peace with Hot Edward. She also hinted at the possibility of marriage between her and him, but that never happened. So Margaret was just like, well, what am I supposed to do? Peaced out of Scotland, apparently. She headed to her homeland, France, where she made an ally of her cousin, King Louis the 11th. And then in a shocking surprise twist, it seems like he kind of mediated this, but she allowed a meeting with Edward's, Hot Edward's former supporter, Warwick. Remember Warwick? He was the one who, he was working with Richard, Duke of York, against Margaret back in the day. But here's what happened. Warwick had been also supporting Hot Edward, like he's fully on team Hot Edward. But then he switched sides because he was like, Hot Edward, I found you the perfect woman to marry. And Edward was like, ooh, sorry, I can't. Guess what? I secretly married Elizabeth Woodville, who is maybe a Luxembourgese water witch, in a secret sexy marriage. Warwick was so mad about that. He wanted revenge against Edward for that. And the whole enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so in this wild and interesting plot twist that actually happened, so Warwick and Margaret teamed up. So to cement this new wild and unanticipated alliance, Warwick's daughter Anne Neville was married to Margaret's son Edward, the Prince of Wales. Margaret insisted that Warwick return to England to prove himself before she followed, just to be like, are you just like double-crossing here? Like, you know, are you just pretending to be on my side? So he did. He went back to England. And with his help, guess what happened? Team Lancastrians emerged victorious. They put King Henry VI back on the throne, and Hot Edward was now sent running off into the wilderness. So this is just like the king switcheroo. It's like, it's Henry, and then he's in a coma, and then it's Richard, and that's Henry again, and then Edward takes over, but then guess what? Henry takes back over again, except he has nothing to do with it, and like just wants to be a little monk guy wandering the desert. So then, Margaret, her son, Prince Edward, and her daughter-in-law, Anne Neville, were ready to follow Warwick back to England, but the tables had turned back in favor of Team Hot Edward. Warwick was defeated and killed by Hot Edward in the Battle of Barnet in 1471. So Henry had only been king for 6 months, by the end of which he was like categorically insane. Because I just feel so badly for him. This just like was not the life he wanted, but it's like, you're the son of the king, and here you go. Do this stuff. Like, poor him, honestly. So Margaret was forced to lead her own army. She's like, no problem. I've done this. My mother did this. My grandmother did this. At the Battle of Tewkesbury on May 4th, 1471, at which her forces were defeated and her 17-year-old son, Prince Edward, was killed. The circumstances of his death have never been made clear. It is not known whether he was killed in the actual fighting or if he was executed after the battle because he was Henry's heir, etc. So she was captured. Hot Edward relegated her to the Tower of London, and this is where we get to our season theme. Women in towers and the assholes who put them there. Was Hot Edward an asshole? I mean, probably, but not the biggest one in this story. So she sent to the Tower of London, which at that point was just like a castle, not a prison. When she heard the outcome, like when she heard that the battle had lost, that her side had lost, she attempted to flee capture with her daughter-in-law, Anne Neville, but they were apprehended 3 days later by Sir William Stanley, at which point she learned of her son's death, and she had to be bodily dragged from where she was hiding. 4 days after that, she came face-to-face with Hot Edward. She reportedly screamed abuses at him. Don't blame her. Well, he responded mildly that she would be treated honorably. In other words, she had no reason to fear her execution. In fact, she was sort of like a prize of war, or what do you call it? She was in the king's retinue when he entered London victoriously to be like, guess what? I'm back, king again. And she was sort of paraded around as a prisoner. And remember how the people of England did not like her? They still didn't. So as she was forced marched through the city streets, people hurled obscenities at her, while mud and debris was flung at her. And remember how when she first arrived, they were like, everyone's so excited, we have to make sure the roofs are strong enough to stand for all the crowds that'll be there, and now they're just throwing mud at her. So she's taken to the tower, where she was informed that, guess what, her husband had died now also. He was almost 100% assassinated because they just had to stop being like, you're the king, no, you're the king. So she begged to be given custody of his body, but it was instead displayed to the public so there could be no question. Henry had lost, York had won, and the war was over. Not really. So in terms of women in towers, so her stay in the tower was brief, roughly 6 weeks. After that, she was quietly moved to Wallingford Castle and put in the custody of Alice Chaucer, the Dowager Duchess of Suffolk. So Alice was the widow of Margaret's one-time most trusted counselor, William de la Pole, Duke of Suffolk, who had been assassinated 21 years before. Alice had also served as her chief lady-in-waiting. And in fact, their history goes all the way back. She's one of the people who was chosen to escort Margaret as a teenage bride back in 1445. By this point, Margaret, just so you know, she's 41 years old. What a life she's lived. Honestly, that's basically my same age, and I've never led an army in battle. So, more about Alice. Why am I telling you so much about Alice? Because maybe later this season, this will become interesting and important and pertinent. So Alice's husband had died. Her son, John de la Pole, was married to Hot Edward's sister, Elizabeth. So she was just a woman with a good instinct for survival. She knew kind of which team to be on when. So at this point, Margaret is 41. Alice was in her 60s, and she was now the prison guard of her former, boss. And she was paid 5 marks a week. I don't know if that was a lot or not. So for the next 4 years, these two women lived in Wallingford Castle without disturbance. And unfortunately, without having left any clue as to what was going on between them. Probably a lot of stitching. I don't know. Music playing. Book reading. Alice died in 1475, and Margaret's fortune turned in theory. So she had just been a prisoner, effectively, with her sort of friend Alice. But basically, while she was there, what had happened is that under the kingship of Hot Edward, England had decided to launch an invasion of France, partially because they were still just really mad about Margaret and she was French, so they were attacking where she was from. But let's see. So England had little appetite for war, even with France. Hot Edward didn't really want to go to war with them, so he instead negotiated a peace settlement that included some various terms, and one of them is the return of Margaret to France in exchange for a ransom. So they're like, we'll give her back to you if you pay us money. And they were like, sure, I don't know why they wanted her back, but cool. Margaret was of no value in England, and she posed no threat to England abroad, so her release meant little to Hot Edward by 1475 when she was released. So to Margaret, it meant the chance to return home, where her father, good King René, still living. Let's see. Oh, she was of no value in England, but she was still of some value in France. Oh, I see. So France wanted her. That's why they were willing to pay money. So she landed in France in January 1476. By March, she was forced to sign away any inheritance or right she might have to Lorraine through her deceased mother, or Anjou, Bar, and Provence through her father. In return for signing this, she received a pension of 6,000 crowns from her cousin, who was the king, to live on, which provided her with just enough comfort until her death. And it let the king with a better chance to absorb those territories into, like, France. So let's see. Margaret had an older sister called Yolanda. Both of them survived all of their brothers. And none of them had an heir. So, oh, okay. So her son, like, everyone's dead. It's like, who's going to inherit Lorraine, the place that they were from? So the Duchy of Lorraine and its title passed to Yolanda, Margaret's older sister, who passed it along to her oldest son. But Margaret's actions angered Yolanda, and the two quarreled, souring what was never a close relationship. So Margaret turned to good King René and wrote to him to request she be allowed to make her home at his court in Provence. Permission granted, she lived with him and her stepmother, Jeanne de Laval, for the next 4 years. Good King René passed away in July 1480, at which point Marguerite was finally and completely without any family members alive whatsoever. Per her cousin's plans, Anjou was absorbed into France, Provence passed to a cousin, and Bar passed to her sister Yolande, who again passed off to her son. Margaret chose to return to Anjou, where she went to move into a place called the Château de Souze, owned by a man who had faithfully served her father. His name was Francis de la Vignoise, and there are passing rumors of a romance between the two, but I mean, it's, there's not any like factual reasons to think that. And while it's nice to wish that Margaret had some like romantic love in her like later years, we don't know that for sure, but you know what? I think so. I think she got her groove back. So let me see. So she's living in Souze, and then her health began to fail shortly after her 52nd birthday in 1482. You know what? She's like the stress of her life, of course. She wrote her will that August, although she had little to give away since she had like inherited nothing, and she passed away on August 25th, 1482. She was interred in Angers Cathedral alongside her parents, and then like literally everybody French who died ever. Her remains were removed and scattered by revolutionaries during the French Revolution. There's a lot of looting of tombs and throwing around of bones in the French Revolution. So Margaret is a major character in William Shakespeare's history plays. She appears in Henry VI, Part 1 and 2 and 3, as well as in Richard III. She's the only character to appear alive in all four plays. But due to the length of the plays, many of her lines are usually cut, which sucks because, honestly, if you watch The Hollow Crown, she is the best character. She's played by Sophie Okonedo. Amazing. Every moment she's on screen, I'm just like, more please. So Shakespeare portrays Margaret as an intelligent, ruthless woman who easily dominates her husband, which is like correct. That is what she seemed to have been like. In Henry VI, Part 2, Shakespeare shows her having an affair with Somerset, and mourning his death by carrying around his severed head. And you know what? That is the first of twice this season of Vulgar History I'm going to tell you about a woman who allegedly carried around the severed head of her dead lover. Fun fact. Let's see, in Henry VI Part 3, she personally stabs Richard, Duke of York, in the battlefield. Good for her. And then becomes suicidal when Edward is killed in front of her. Because the holocron like combines everything, but she shows up, I think, in Richard III, and she's basically just this like witch who's just like, everything is terrible, you're all gonna die. And everyone's like, crazy, we don't listen to you. And then it turns out she's right about everything, a very Cassandra moment. For an actress, what a role. Honestly, you get to play all the things. Yeah, so Shakespeare has her return to royal court in Richard III. Oh yeah, in her first appearance in that play, she dramatically curses everybody for their roles in the downfall of the House of Lancaster. And all of her curses come to pass. As the noblemen she curses are betrayed and executed. And each character reflects on her curse before his execution, being like, oh, she was right. Her prominence in Shakespeare. So, what I said before, like, so a lot of people cut her parts out of the plays, which is a bad idea, because then you're just left with a lot of men in the play, which makes it much more boring. But in more recent years, some people have reinterpreted the play to make her be in it more. So an adaptation called Margaret of Anjou by Elizabeth Schaeffer and Philippa Kelly was performed in 2016 in London by Jove Theatre Company. So in 2018, the Royal Exchange Theatre in Manchester premiered Queen Margaret using all the lines spoken by Margaret over the four plays with additional material by playwright Jeannie O'Hare. And the thing is, she's known as the She-Wolf of France, and that's like an insult because, well, the whole like English people didn't like France, and they're like, who's this woman who's like leading armies and whatever. But honestly, nothing I've read makes me think like she's a villain at all, but she's like very much like a major woman villain of British history. Apparently, not to me. I quite enjoy learning about her. So we're going to give her her score. How exciting is this? We haven't scored anyone in such a long time. Now, I thought about changing some of the categories, but I'm like, no, I have to keep consistent categories so we can keep comparing where everybody falls and just get this master list of people in order of scandaliciousness. The first qualifier is scandaliciousness, which is just like how much of a gossipy good time was her story. And frankly, like there was the rumors of, oh, did she have an affair? And was her son illegitimate and whatever? But like that was made up, like it was not based on anything. She wasn't like running around tits out or whatever. And I'm going to give her a 3 for scandaliciousness because there were the rumors, but she herself didn't really do anything in a scandaliciousness sort of way. Scheminess was great. So if we look at the scheminess of her, like first to just like low-key subtly like take control over her husband, the coma king, and how she kept like kicking Richard out. She tried to assassinate him twice. I just remembered that. Then she's like leading armies. She was just then like making the alliance with Mary in Scotland. Like I'm going to give her an 8.5 for scheminess because no, I'm going to give her a 9 for scheminess. Because she was just like unrelentingly, like she got it done, scheminess wise. Her significance is like she was not the mother of a king, which inevitably gives people some significance points. She was significant because she's a majorly significant figure in the Cousins War era. Like she was leading battles, like she was, without her, I don't know. This all would have gone on really differently, so that does give her quite a bit of significance. I'm going to give her a 6 for significance. The sexism bonus is how much did the patriarchy bring her down. And frankly, I don't know, it's tricky. Like, you know, she was sold off in marriage at age 14, but that's kind of like happened to everybody. And then her husband wasn't terrible, but that doesn't mean it doesn't suck to be sold off in marriage at age 14. Then people, like the whole She-Wolf of France, the whole like, oh, is she a French whore? Like, people treated her badly because she was French. So this is like a sexism / xenophobia bonus. Then the fact she's leading armies made people be like, is she a witch? Whatever. Like, there's bullshit there. I'm going to give her an 8 for sexism bonus. So where does that put her? 17. 26. So this puts her, that's the same score as Lady Anne Stanley, Anne Askew, Ethelfled, Lady of the Mercians, and Frances Howard, tits out. So we're starting off strong this season of Vulgar History. Now, a thing that I wanted to bring up in this podcast is that in this hiatus between episodes, I've been reading and learning lots about the world and history and what history gets written and who is writing it and stuff like that. And my research, I don't know, expertise or interest is very much in women in British history, medieval / Renaissance period. That's just kind of where I'm coming from. That's what I know the most about. And I was like, oh, should I like try and make the show be about like more different countries and different nationalities of people and stuff? And I'm like, there's so many people who are doing that work. I don't need to like come in here and like do it badly. So what I wanted to do is to take this opportunity to highlight some people who are doing this work and I think is so worth knowing about. So there is an author named Alok Ved Menon, who is on Instagram. They describe themselves as author, performer, speaker, fashionista, who has a master's degree in sociology and also in gender studies. And so if you go to Alok's Instagram page, there's a link there for book reports. But also if you just follow them on Instagram, you're going to get all the new ones that come out. So basically, it's incredible. I love these book reports they do. So it's kind of like based on these deep dives that they're doing. Like Alok is doing the work, and I just want to share the fact that this is where you can find it. So for instance, stuff like how men define nature to oppress women, the invention of the sex binary. It used to be illegal for women to wear pants, a history of cross-dressing laws. Women with mustaches, gender and imperialism. So what they are is sort of like a slideshow on Instagram of a book that Alok has read and kind of relates the main facts in that. And I've learned so much about the history of queer people, of intersex people, of non-binary people, and how that's not like a new thing that's just happening. And there was really Alok, I first discovered them as a guest on Laverne Cox's podcast, The Laverne Cox Show, which is so good also. But there was a thing, I'm going to paraphrase, but Alok basically said, like, not seeing people who are like, and so, who remind them of them in the world today as much, then so they find comfort in reading history and finding people like them. And just as a reminder, they're like this, like there's always been all kinds of people in history, and they've been celebrated in different cultures. It's not always been like what it's like now with all the awful anti-trans legislation and stuff going on. And I just really connected with that in the sense of finding comfort in reading about things and people in history, and just kind of feeling as part of this like long human race that's always had all kinds of different people in it. And we're not like, we're living in this bizarre moment now of pandemic era, and people have lived through stuff like this before. And I find comfort knowing that like the human race just keeps going. And so anyway, I'll put a link to Alok's Instagram in the show notes, and I super encourage following them just to get to learn more about this history that is not as readily available. But again, like Alok is doing the work to bring these stories to light, and I think that's so great, and I think that's so important, and I think it's a good to be well-rounded in your knowledge of, especially if you're into history. Just like one of the other things I've been thinking about in this hiatus time is who wrote the history that I've read and what you know, we've talked about this on the podcast, like, who was, like, you know, people writing about Cleopatra, who just, like, thought she was awful. The same way as people writing about Margaret of Anjou, like, history is written by the victors. And so it's like, there's so many people who are forgotten. And even the people on this podcast who are often lesser talked about women from British royal history, like, at least there's something written about them. There's so many people who it takes such a deep dive to find anything about them. And sometimes there's just nothing, you know, like, even in this story, like, we don't know what Margaret and Alice were doing for those, like, several years together in the castle, because there's no written record of it. Like, even the women we look at who are like, this is the princess of whatever, it's like, she's probably born in this year, we don't know. Like, there's so many people whose stories we don't know. And I think it's important to try and, if we can't learn specifically about them, then to learn what the world was like and imagine what it was like for people who were not royals and not nobles. So that's my recommendation for today. And there's going to be more episodes coming, because season 4 is here. It's happening. It's real. We're live. We're loving it. And we're going to learn about some more women trapped in towers, assholes who put them there. Oh, I have my notes. What are the things I need to tell you? So all the links for everything are all over the place, you know. You can follow me on the socials at Vulgar History on Twitter, Vulgar History Pod on Instagram. And then I have a Patreon. And if you don't know what a Patreon is, it's a website where you basically pledge a certain amount of money per month. And then by doing that, you get some extra content from me. So if you pledge a certain amount, I think it's $5 a month, I'm doing extra Patreon podcasts every month. So I've been doing them every month since at least October. And that's just some, if you're just like, I need some more Anne in my ear holes, that's where you can get it. So when you pledge the Patreon, then you get to listen to all the ones I've done before. It's called So This Asshole. It's where I talk about men who are terrible. And then you also, when you're on the Patreon, you can vote to help me choose who I'm going to talk about next, stuff like that. But it's not just like pay money and get podcasts, like, pay money and that helps me because I don't have advertisers and there are fees and costs involved in being a podcaster. And I really appreciate that. And then, of course, the easiest, most cost-effective way to support this podcast is to subscribe, rate, and review, like everybody says. I would love to get some more reviews just to drown out the voice of the person who said I talk too fast. So if you want to say, like, Vulgar History is a great podcast and Anne's voice is such a good speed, feel free to let your little podcast app know that. Anyway, yeah, I'm really excited to be back. And this is going to be a fun ride / depressing ride. And I'm glad we're all here together again. So, I mean, hopefully you're vaccinated. Hopefully you're en route to be vaccinated. And whether you are or not, even if you are, like, remember, masks on, tits out.
Nowadays, trends and news cycles change faster than we can blink. But there are some things that withstand the test of time. And if you're looking for a connection to something timeless, and maybe also a glimpse of life at a slower pace, I believe everyone can relate to the very human experiences explored in Jane Austen's novels. And that's where I come in. My name is Alison Larkin. I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin. I spent a lot of my childhood in the part of England where Jane Austen lived and wrote, and now that I live in the States, nothing gives me a sense of homecoming quite like narrating her books. On this show, you'll listen to award-winning narration. I'll give myself a pat on the back for that, as well as conversations with actors, writers, and other fascinating people who all share a passionate love for Jane Austen. So please, join me as we embark on a wonderful journey through Jane Austen's work. Be sure to listen and subscribe to The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin, wherever you get your podcasts.